Welcome to today's Journal Club webinar. My name is Kayla Jenkins. I am the Communications Assistant at the Society for Nutrition, Education, and Behavior. I'm glad y'all could join us for our presentation today. So if you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar, you will see a Handouts tab. Here you'll find the slides for today, and feel free to download the slides and take notes as you follow along with today's presentation. We will take questions at the end of the webinar, so type your questions in at the question box at any point throughout the presentation so that we can moderate them to our presenters. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas for future journal clubs. This is the sixth webinar in our series, so as the end of the series draws nearer, we are looking for topics for the upcoming fall semester. And lastly, watch for a follow-up email to be sent by the end of the day on Wednesday. This will include a link to the recording for today's session, the slide handout, and the CEU certificate that you will be earning for your attendance today. So our moderator today is Virginia Quick. She's Assistant Research Professor at Rutgers University.
Great. Thank you, Kayla. And we're lucky today to have two wonderful speakers with us. The first is Jamie Dolley. She is a professor of community nutrition at Cornell University and directs the food and nutrition education and community programs, including the Northeast Regional Nutrition Education and Obesity Prevention Center of Excellence. We also have Dr. Cindy Fitch. She is the Associate Dean of Programming and Research for the West Virginia University Extension Service, and she has over 30 years of experience in research, curriculum development, and working with children and families. So we're glad to have them here today for our webinar and be able to talk to us about what does evidence-based mean for nutrition educators, best practices for choosing nutrition education interventions based on the strength of evidence.
Thank you, Ginger. My name's Jamie Dollahide. I'm really happy to be here with you today, and Cindy and I are thrilled to be able to share some of the work and thinking that went into our JNEB report, the title of which is on the screen. This report grew out of the real push for evidence-based programs following the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010. And what we perceived in a group that we were working with at the time as some confusion in the field about what different types of evidence meant. So I hope that this is helpful to you today. My slides are not moving. Now they are, sorry. Can everyone see it? Ginger? Okay.
Yes, we can see it. We can see it.
Okay. Thank you. Somehow it hung up there for a minute. Okay, so our objectives today are to look at the different types of evidence, to consider the strengths and limitations of each, to identify best practices for choosing an intervention, and to understand ways that an intervention might be adapted while maintaining fidelity to the original design of the intervention. Excuse me. So why evidence-based nutrition education interventions? The goal is to have effective programs that actually change people's food choice behavior in ways that lead to healthier lifestyles. And that then would be evidence-based practice. We need to be good stewards of funds that support our work, and so nutrition education interventions need to be effective or evidence-based. We need evidence to ensure that a given intervention or program is effective, and the kind of evidence we're talking about is outcomes, so changes in knowledge, skills, behavior, and so forth. Yet it's hard to build strong evidence for community-based programs using randomized controlled trials with rigorous controls because of the importance of context. In other words, different contexts influence programs differently so that what is effective in one context may or may not be in another. So as we looked into how to describe the various kinds and levels of evidence available and what was in the literature, it became clear that different fields use some of the same terms somewhat differently. We've attempted to sort through these terms and hope to present them in a way that can inform nutrition education practice. So we need evidence on which to base our practice. We'll focus on these questions. How do we obtain this evidence? What kinds of evidence are important? And what are the difficulties with getting convincing evidence for community nutrition programs? So if we think about research to practice, we might think about it in three simple steps. Very simplistically, we develop an intervention, we test it. If it's effective, we put it into practice. This comes out of the medical paradigm. And so on the right there, you can see a graphic that shows basic research or bench, randomized control trials, that are bedside. So, you know, we often, in talking about translational research, we often talk about bench to bedside. And so an example of this medical paradigm might be the development, the development of a drug and testing it in an animal model as basic bench research. And then this drug would be tried out in a series of randomized control trials in which patients are randomized to a control, no drug, or intervention group, drug. If the results are positive, then it moves into clinical practice. It really isn't quite that simple, but this is the most basic paradigm that we talk about in terms of translational research. So it sounds simpler than it is. There are many more steps than this shows, but this diagram gives us an idea to sort of launch from. So how does this apply to our world? Well, in nutrition education, the paradigm might look like this. So there's an intervention developed, there are randomized control trials, and then it goes into community practice if it works. But community nutrition is messy. And translating interventions from randomized control trials into community practice brings special challenges. So we have to think about who's the target audience. What culture and language does this audience have? What's the culture of the community in which they live? Who are the community partners that are necessary to deliver the intervention? What's the cost? What is food access and availability like to our participants? What's the cost of food for them? What about transportation to get to sites where the intervention is delivered or to get to food? What about the walkability or bikeability of the given community? These are just some of the things that might have to be taken into account. So what we will do today is look at the different types of evidence that might be brought to bear to ensure that our nutrition education programs are as effective as possible. Now we have three main types of evidence. We have research tested, practice tested, and emerging evidence. This is a continuum from the most rigorous research on the left to no intervention research on the right. We'll look at each of these and look at the strengths and weaknesses that go along with it. So beginning with the research tested, we have randomized control trials, which are considered the gold standard for research evidence. The way RCTs are carried out, we usually talk about them as efficacy trials, and this is when they're done under ideal conditions. And so one decides if the intervention under ideal conditions is efficacious. There would be a control group, and there would be, the participants would be randomized to the control and intervention group. there would be a carefully designed protocol that would be carefully followed and monitored, and the intervention would be delivered as designed with fidelity to the original design. All of this would be carried out by carefully trained research personnel. An efficacy trial is usually conducted in only one site. It has internal validity. Now, this is a pretty important term. What it means is that there is cause and effect established under the prescribed internal circumstances of the research trial. So it's internal to that particular trial. On the other hand, there's no evidence that this intervention will work in other contexts. It may work in, you know, rural North Dakota, but not in urban inner city in New York City, for example. So internal validity is the only thing that we have here. So another type of research-tested study is a quasi-experimental study. And so this is important as we begin to think about moving to effectiveness trials, which are actually pragmatic trials. They're called pragmatic trials. And this research shows that, in fact, the intervention works in a variety of different places. It's effective in a variety of different places. So on the positive side, there's either a control or a comparison group that is not randomized. So you could have a randomized control trial with a control group in which the participants or the groups are randomized. But you could also have a quasi-experimental design where there is a comparison group that is not randomized. Also on the plus side, carefully designed protocols are used just as we talked about with efficacy trials, and there is fidelity to the intervention as designed and delivered. Trained research personnel are used, but at this point, with effectiveness trials, normally what happens is that the intervention is actually delivered by program staff rather than by research staff. It's usually done in multiple sites. And this leads to external validity. External validity being the term that's used when an intervention is effective in other contexts where external factors, such as different populations, different environments, may influence the outcome. There are, however, limits on external validity. And these would include the number and type of research sites that are chosen, and the controls on fidelity to the intervention as designed. So I said above that there is fidelity to the intervention, but as practitioners begin to deliver it, then the possibility of deviance from the design as intended can happen. So those are limits to the external validity. So how do we apply this in nutrition education studies? Well, direct nutrition education is messy enough. So when we're looking only at the individual or family, we have a fair number of things that need to be considered. And here you have just the inner part of the socio-ecological model showing the individual and the family. So who is the target audience? What is their culture, their language, their household resources, their transportation? What are other specific psychosocial and household environment type specifics that need to be taken into account? Now, community resources are also important here, such as availability of healthy foods, because those clearly impact how the individual and family is able to make healthy choices with an intervention. However, normally, we don't spend a lot of time on that in our direct nutrition education. Beyond considering the target audience, we must also ensure that the organization that's delivering the intervention is prepared in terms of financial and human resources. And we must ensure that the partners are engaged that we need to access the audience. So this is direct nutrition education. PSEs are even more complex, as you can imagine. So policy systems and environmental change interventions take into account some of these more distal layers of the socio-ecological model. Although the individual is still at the center of the SEM, as well as the home and family, PSE interventions must take into account the multi-level, multifactorial influences on food and activity choices. For example, access to healthy foods in communities, that might be a target of the PSE intervention. The food assistance programs, are they available? That might be a target. Local public health programs and policies may actually be the agency bringing about the intervention, or may need to be at the table for that to be carried out. And things like point of purchase information, promotions in restaurants, and so forth. So you can see that there are a variety of different things that have to be considered when a PSE intervention is developed and then tested. So research-tested evidence for policy systems and environmental change interventions would most likely use a quasi-experimental design, since randomizing at the community level is extremely difficult, even impossible. So that's not to say that there might not be a control community. There are many studies that have those, but they're not randomized. So other than research-tested evidence, which is what we've talked about so far, what other types of evidence can help? Oh, sorry, I missed this slide, so I'm going back here. Okay, so for research-tested interventions, there are a number of challenges of conducting them. They have intensive time commitment, highly trained staff, and highly motivated participants. An example of that might be the National Diabetes Prevention Program, which is a highly successful research-tested intervention that demonstrated that lifestyle changes resulting in moderate weight loss decreased the risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 60%. The intervention, however, included working with a lifestyle coach in group and individual settings and having access to a fitness center to promote physical activity. So all of these bring about challenges, and not all programs in real-world application have the financial resources, the staff with the skills to do this, and always cultural differences in the population may affect success. So now let's look at other types of evidence. So the second major type of evidence is practice-tested evidence. Now, this isn't a typo on the slide. At the top, you see practice-tested, and then in the definition here, you see practice-based. So this is practice-based evidence, is the kind of evidence that is derived from or describing contexts, experiences, and practices of nutrition educators working in real-world practice settings. If that evidence is evaluated sufficiently using valid and reliable measures, then it can be called practice-tested. So, a valid and reliable measure might be, for example, a well-designed and tested questionnaire that had undergone validity testing to ensure that the questions were asking what was intended to be measured and the participants understand the questions as intended, and reliability testing to ensure that the data are replicable. On the positive side for practice-tested evidence, or practice-based evidence either, really, is that it has viable validity. Now, we talked about internal validity, external validity, and here is viable validity. And I really love this term because it means it's feasible in practice. It actually works out there with educators. On the negative side is that there's really no control group. Hardly ever is there a control group in this kind of evidence. Generally, there's no comparison group either, other than just the comparison of pre to post intervention data among the participants. So for example, a questionnaire that they filled out before the intervention and after the intervention. So they're their own control, but that's not nearly as rigorous as having another control group, or in particular, randomizing participants to a control and intervention group. In addition, there are several frequent shortcomings to using practice-based evidence. One is the lack of fidelity to the intervention as designed. When it goes into practice, educators change it at will sometimes. And, you know, sessions are too short, so they leave things out, and they want to add something just because they're fond of it and that sort of thing. So fidelity to the intervention is often lost with practice-based evidence. Not always, but often. And secondly, the data collection is often done by educators. And this is not rigorous at all, because social desirability is introduced here. And although social desirability of participant respondents can certainly be occur in any of these types of studies, it is more likely to occur, much more likely, if the person that the participants have developed a relationship with as their educator is then collecting the data. So finally, let's look at emerging evidence. Emerging evidence comes from interventions that have been developed and implemented in practice that show promise based on their underlying theory and logic, but lack data from an evaluation demonstrating any effect. This is the weakest kind of evidence. Now, this slide is just intended to be a summary as we look back at research-tested, practice-tested, and emerging evidence and the continuum across there. On the left, you have, on the left of the continuum, you have the most rigorous kinds of evidence, and on the right, you have actually no research evidence. So along that continuum, we have various levels of rigor. The translational model shows the continuum moving from research to practice, as I just said. However, in community nutrition, we often see the continuum moving from right to left. And so, for example, we develop an intervention based on sound theory and so forth, and then we test it in, you know, with pre-post questionnaires kind of thing, and then we move to a randomized control trial or a quasi-experimental study. So that is not the translational model that most of us have been introduced to, where there are T's standing for each point along the continuum, T1, T2, T3, T4, left to right. But in fact, in our practice, and I will just say in my own practice, we have a direct nutrition education intervention that we developed. We had emerging evidence. We tested it and actually have a publication now that is practice tested, and we're currently subjecting it to a randomized control trial. So the continuum really can go both directions. One last term that we wanted to introduce to you is research-based interventions. Now, at the beginning, what I said was that in different fields, some of these terms mean different things. And there was a point in my own life where I thought if something was a research-based intervention, it was similar to a randomized control trial or a quasi-experimental trial. However, we hear this term used a lot in our world, and I think it needs to be distinguished from research-tested interventions. What this term seems to have come to mean in our world is that it has to do with the content. and that the content of an intervention is based on sound scientific research. So, for example, we know that fruits and vegetables are inversely in the dietary intake of fruits and vegetables, inversely correlated with the incidence of chronic disease. A program that focuses on fruit and vegetable intake for this purpose would be research-based. However, we don't know if that program actually increases intake without testing its effectiveness. So the design of the program may not be effective to actually increase the intake of that cute little girl there. Or it might, but the term refers to the content, which is that fruits and vegetables have all of these antioxidants that we need, that an increased intake of fruits and vegetables is correlated with a decrease in many of the chronic diseases. So I want now to turn the presentation over to Cindy, and she'll begin by telling us how to choose a good intervention.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining us. And I want to talk about choosing a good intervention. So we do this a lot in extension. When we think about interventions, we think about various domains. For example, we think about what is the evidence for that intervention? Is it appropriate for the needs of the audience, the funders, the program? Is the content based on research? Is it relevant and up to date? Let me just confirm that you are seeing my screen. I want to make sure that that is true.
Yes, Cindy, we're seeing your screen.
Perfect, thanks. All right, so then talk about a little bit about the audience. Can it be used without significant adaptation? And I am sorry about the sirens going on in the background. My windows are closed. Is the reading level appropriate? Is the cultural, the fit the cultural age development of the audience? And then finally, is the implementing agency, is it appropriate for the implementing agency? Do they have the staff that are qualified and capable of implementing the intervention? Do they have the financial resources needed to train the staff and to implement the intervention? So these are some of the things that we think about when we're choosing a good intervention, when there is no perfect evidence-based intervention for your purpose. We chose this conceptual framework on this slide as kind of a summary for best practices for choosing evidence-based programs. And you can see Jamie's continuum there going across the slide. This framework was developed by Spencer and colleagues from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it displays a continuum of evidence by graphing two continua against each other. So you can think of the quality of the evidence from weak to rigorous. You could think about the public health impact of the evidence, including effectiveness, reach, feasibility, sustainability, and transferability. Note that with low impact and weak evidence, the practices or the interventions might be considered emerging, as Jamie talked about. And then moving up and to the right, we see the best interventions would have strong research-tested evidence and would be effective, feasible, sustainable, and transferable in practice. We haven't talked about sustainability or transferability today, but clearly those are important characteristics of an intervention. So what if the perfect intervention isn't available? We know if we use evidence-based intervention, that provides a level of confidence that the outcomes will benefit the population if the population is similar. If the program is delivered with fidelity to the design and the methods. But sometimes programs need to be adapted. The group at the University of Wisconsin has developed a very nice document on when and how to adapt an intervention so that fidelity is maintained. And you can see the link to that document there on the slide. So acceptable adaptations are adaptations that maintain fidelity to the original design and content of the program as it was tested. Adaptation is useful when the intervention identified is the best fit of all those interventions that are available for a given program, but maybe not perfect for the audience and the context. And you can see some of the things, the acceptable adaptations to think about. An example that I could give you is Dining with Diabetes, a program that was developed here at West Virginia University, but New Mexico State University adapted it to create a program called Kitchen Creations that was more appropriate for the indigenous people that they worked with. They modified the program to build on a strong sense of community and collaboration during the classes. In the original Dining with Diabetes, we do food demonstrations with sample recipes, and then participants taste the food that we prepared. In Kitchen Creations, they have the participants work together in groups to prepare the foods. And the foods that they prepare are foods that are traditional in the culture of the indigenous people in New Mexico. So this is an example of an adaptation that that is acceptable, that maintains fidelity to the program. Unacceptable adaptations move away from the intervention being delivered with fidelity to the design and the methods. For example, if someone says, well, I don't have time to do the food activity, the food demonstrations or the food preparation, don't have time to do the physical activity, both of which are critical pieces to the learning, then you lower participant engagement and you eliminate key skills or messages. So it's not the same program. So the last 2 points, a lack of capacity of the organization to deliver this intervention means that sometimes it can't be delivered with fidelity, and therefore you should probably look for a different intervention to use. So those are some ways to think about choosing interventions. I want to call your attention to some resources. Certainly, you hope you have read the article that Jamie and Jan Carroll and I wrote for the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, where we talk about some of these things. There is an expanded glossary in the Center for Training and Research Translation at the University of North Carolina that's very helpful. The CDC has a tool for choosing an evidence-based intervention called the Toward Evidence-Informed Practice Program, and the article that is referenced there gives you a good description of it. They have both an assessment tool and they have a planning tool. So those are good references to have. The SnapEd Toolkit is a wonderful reference, a searchable guide developed by the Regional Nutrition Education Center of Excellence Southern, the Southern Regional Nutrition Education Center of Excellence. It includes direct nutrition education interventions as well as multi-level interventions and public health approaches. All are evidence-based, but they span the continuum from research-tested to practice-tested to emerging interventions. And they were designed for SnapEd implementing agencies, but they're useful for anyone who's implementing interventions in community nutrition. And then the CDC Guide to Community Preventive Services, sometimes called the Community Guide, is a collection of evidence-based findings of the Community Preventive Services Task Force. It's a resource for selecting interventions to improve health and prevent disease at state, community, and organizational levels. The Community Guide reviews include research-tested and practice-based studies that use a range of study designs and that assess both internal and external validity. So those are some good places where you can look for resources. I want to save time for questions, and I think that this does. So I want to, Jamie and I would like to give a big thank you to our co-author, Dr. Jan Carroll from the Colorado State University Extension Services in Fort Collins. She couldn't be with us today because she was traveling, but she had the vision and the idea to look at this definition of evidence-based. We referred to it as a common language. We were all three a member of the SnapEd program development team for land-grant universities, and our colleagues on that team supported us and encouraged us and read the first drafts of the manuscript and gave their feedback. And finally, we want to thank the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior for hosting us. And thank you, Ginger, for being our moderator. So with that, I will finish, turn it back over to Ginger as the moderator, and we will take questions.
Okay, great. Thank you both, Dr. Cindy Fitch, and of course, I know Jane Carroll couldn't be here as well, but also Jamie, for presenting today and sharing with us some of the work that you've done and contributed to the nutrition education and behavior field. So if there are any questions, yes, please do. You can type them in the Q&A box in the GoToWebinar area. So for actually one of the questions that I have from someone listening in today's presentation, they were wondering, and this could be directed to either both Jamie or Cindy, if you could kind of explain what TSEs are. So if one of you could kind of explain a little bit.
Yeah, Jamie, do you want to take that one?
Sure, I'll take a shot at that. So PSE stands for Policies, Systems, and Environmental Change. And so those would be interventions that use strategies, if you will, that affect the outer layers of the socio-ecological model. So for example, they would focus on strategies to make healthy food more available in corner stores, for example. Sometimes they work with cities to develop walking paths or walkable streets, a variety of different things like that. So policies, I believe, I don't have the definitions in front of me, but I believe policies are identified as being a sort of written rules, guidelines, regulations, that support healthy food choices or healthy food and activity choices. So for example, a healthy meetings policy would fall into this category. the changes in school lunch that came about out of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. Those would be policies coming actually from the federal level. Mm-hmm. And so then we have systems, and systems are pretty much what it sounds like. I want to use the word systems in the definition, and I know I'm not supposed to do that, but at any rate, so it's changing the way things are done. And an example that I can give you, that is some research done out of our center, is a program in which medical personnel, a system was put into place in family practice clinics for children to be identified who were at risk for obesity. There was a checklist for the physicians and medical providers to have about certain things that they should do with a child that would promote physical activity for the child. They gave them resources. They referred the family to the Expanded Food Nutrition Education Program, for example. And so it was a whole shift in what was happening in that group of clinics. And then environmental changes, I think, is probably the easiest to understand, maybe, I don't know. It's making changes. As I guess I said in the very beginning, it's making changes in things like availability, accessibility of healthy food and physical activity opportunities. So changing the environment so that people are more likely to make healthy choices. So making the healthy choice the easy choice is one way that it's often said.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Jamie, for kind of giving a nice definition and examples trying to explain what PSEs are. So we have another question, and I guess I can either Jamie or Cindy, you could answer this as well. So there seems to be a difference between the SNAP-Ed definition of research-based and evidence-based. And this kind of goes back to what Jamie described in the early part of the presentation. And so they're wondering, are the qualifications that Jamie described for the research evidence-based more rigorous than the SNAP-Ed definition of research evidence-based?
Well, that's a very good question, because that was part of the impetus for writing the article in the first place, right, Jamie? There was some confusion.
I think that's why we brought in this term research-based versus research-tested. If I'm not mistaken, I believe what SNAP-Ed has gone towards is research-tested. I mean, evidence-based, if you use the term evidence-based, that's a general term. So it can be research-tested, it can be practice-tested, it can be just practice-based, it can be emerging evidence. That's still evidence. But it's along that continuum. So evidence-based would be the more general term, and then the others would be more specific. But this term research-based it gives us a lot of trouble. And you know, if you look in the literature and you talk to people, you find that different disciplines look at research-based quite differently. I'm relatively certain that in medical research, research-based is the same thing as research-tested. But as I've worked in extension and public health, it seems to me that what when people say, "Oh, this curriculum is research-based," what they mean is that the content is based on sound research. But that doesn't mean that the curriculum's been tested in terms of its design and delivery.
Okay, great. Thank you for clarifying that. Another question we have, they were wondering, what is the body which we can actually assess the evidence-based nutrition education?
Would you say that again?
What is the body which we could assess evidence-based nutrition education?
You mean who is making that assessment?
How would you go about assessing evidence-based nutrition education in basic terms?
So how would an individual do that, or what is the group that does that?
They don't really specify. I mean, I guess either community or individual. How would you, test that it is evidence-based education? I don't know if they want to. What organization or group, I guess they're clarifying.
Okay. So the SNAPFIT toolkit has just undergone a fairly major revision. And that was led by the Regional Nutrition Education and Obesity Prevention Center of Excellence South. But I believe that's now been turned over to ASNA, which is the National SNAP-Ed Association, in collaboration with NCOR. They are entertaining or will be entertaining a submission of new interventions that then a group will look at and determine the level of evidence. CDC does a fair amount of that too, I believe. So if you look in the CDC guide to community preventive services, which Cindy brought to your attention a few minutes ago, that includes research tested and practice-based evidence, interventions with the levels of evidence.
Okay, great. Also, someone just commented, they said another resource could be the Genie tool from the Academy for evaluating nutrition education. So for anybody that's interested in looking at that. All right, so another question we have from, both of your experiences, when do you think is the best time to evaluate a program?
From an extension, and Jamie alluded to it mm-hmm. as well, we often do that emerging evidence first. We think we know our communities and we know what they need, or at least we think we do. So we'll design an intervention to meet a goal in the community, and then if it's popular, if people seem to like it, if people seem to come, if we have a rigorous evaluation that shows we are the people that are in our programs change something based on the learner outcomes we're looking for, then we might say, hey, we're onto something, and we might look for a way to test it against a comparison group or to get more of the research tested intervention so that then we can share it nationally at meetings and publish it. So in my experience with extension, whether it's the best time or not, it tends to be after we have tested something in practice to see that it appeals to our target audience.
Okay.
I think the thing I would add to that, I totally agree with Cindy in terms of doing some of the formative, the emerging formative work first. But all along that continuum, evaluation, as rigorous as possible at the time, needs to be done so that evidence is built.
That's a good point.
Okay. Yeah, great. Thank you. We have a lot of good questions. Another question that we have, they're wondering if either one of you could talk a little bit about addressing community partnerships and collaborations for interventions.
Yes, that is an excellent point. And I'll go back, I hope I think I'm still sharing my screen. So this CDC tool for choosing an evidence-based intervention had some really good tools for working with the community to get community input into the intervention. And because when, you know, an evidence-based intervention doesn't always appeal to people in West Virginia. You know, it's much more important, is it cost effective? Is it well accepted in the community? Is it consistent with community norms and the culture here? Our stakeholders often don't really care whether it's evidence-based or not. So definitely start early to work with your community, to work with partners on the ground, and in our case, partners within the academic community as well. That prevents you from tripping over a lot of landmines that you don't even know are there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. And I think these resources will be really helpful, so I appreciate you sharing them. So let's see, we have another question. On choosing a good intervention, what are some of the evidence-based intervention options for developing countries that are available, and how can they be assessed? Accessed.
Well, I'm probably going to go a bit out on a limb here because I don't know very much about interventions for developing countries, although in my home institution, we have a large and well-respected international nutrition group of faculty, so they could answer this much better than I. But there is work that's done. I mean, I think looking in the published literature, not to see an intervention per se, perhaps, but to look at what's been studied and go in that direction would be useful. I mean, it depends on where the country is too and what the culture is. There's a lot of work that's done now in implementation science. And at one point in working on this presentation, I thought that we ought to talk a little bit about implementation science, but decided that was too far afield. But there is a journal of implementation science, and so there are a lot of folks working in international nutrition that are a part of that particular effort, and looking at, a lot of process evaluation. So what works, but not only what works, but how and why it works. And so going in that direction, I mean, I think talking to people that are actually working in international nutrition would be better, though, because my own experience is all domestic with one exception, which was in Western Europe. So, you know.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you. All right. So another question that we have, and I might have to repeat it. It's a long one. All right. So their question is, and this is probably more directed to Jamie. You indicated that a modification to an intervention could not be made that would result in the participants being less engaged. If one aspect of maybe the intervention was for participants to prepare and taste the food, but the program adapting it thought that maybe it was just too cost intensive, they didn't have enough staff and wanted to change it to food demonstrations, would that be acceptable and modify an intervention?
Cindy's the one that talked about that, so I think I'll...
Okay.
Yeah, and that, I know things like that happen all the time. You don't have the resources. Then it's no longer based on the same evidence, because if you're not doing it with fidelity to the way it was tested, then you don't know that you'll get the same outcomes as the tested one. So what I would do in a situation like that is look at your evaluation piece. Is there a way that you can do that experiment and see if that that change changes your outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you. We have, someone actually mentioned another potential tool for, looking at, see if the intervention was evidence-based, and they had suggested the SNAP-Ed evidence-based checklist. I don't know if that was mentioned before, but for anybody that's
good suggestion.
Interested.
Thank you.
Okay. I think that's part of the toolkit.
Yeah. Okay. Then that would make sense. Gotcha. All right. So, I was wondering if either one of you would be able to kind of comment on maybe some of your challenges and experiences in the past with conducting some of these evidence-based nutrition programs. If you had any suggestions for those that are planning on, adapting or modifying intervention of some sort.
I can speak from the extension perspective in the thought that we really have to adapt it for our community because we're so different. We're whatever. So the challenge is working with our county-based faculty to outline what is critical and should not be changed versus what you can adapt. And that tool that we talked about out of the University of Wisconsin is helpful, providing them with that education. They're always pressed for time, and they're often pressed for resources and money. So my biggest challenge is making sure that they know what they can do, and then what is no makes it then no longer a research-based intervention.
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks. Now, could you? I know sustainability is. I know you weren't able to really touch on that in much detail today, but we're oftentimes. Researchers might get a grant, and then it dries out. There's no money. Do you have any recommendations on how to make a nutrition education program more sustainable in a community?
I think that goes to where you're changing the environment, policy systems and environment.
And I think that the big key to that is that you have all of the important stakeholders involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, Cindy mentioned that in one sense, but if you're looking at interventions that go beyond direct nutrition education, then there's mm-hmm. there's no one person, there's no one organization that can bring about these changes and certainly then can sustain them. And so working with all of the critical stakeholders and developing this over time and then getting buy-in not only from those key stakeholders but also from the community. And we do have examples of that happening. It's a lot of work and it goes
yes.
It doesn't happen in a year. It does not happen in a year. I mean, we've been working on some things at Cornell like that, and it's several years to even begin to see change. But long-term sustainability is going to require lots of buy-in at every level.
Great, thank you. I appreciate it. So we're nearing the end of the session for today's webinar. So before we end, I would just like to thank both, Cindy and Jamie being able to talk with us today about evidence-based research when it comes to nutrition education. And I'm sure if there's any other questions that anybody on the line has, that they could follow up with you at a later point in time. So I'll let Kayla kind of close today's webinar session. She has a couple of things to announce and talk about.
Yeah, thank you, Ginger, and thank you again to our speakers today, Cindy and Jamie, for a very informative session. Just a reminder, when I close the session today, there will be a short survey, and we do appreciate your feedback. Please watch for an email on Wednesday this week. It will include links to today's recording, the handout, and your CEU certificate for attending today's webinar. Be sure to register for Journal Club 7, the next webinar in this series. That webinar takes place next Monday, April 3rd. And then following Journal Club 7 is our new member orientation webinar on Tuesday, April 4th. We encourage all SNEB members to join us. Just for a refresher on how to get the most out of your SNEB membership. And you can log into the SNEB website to register for these upcoming webinars. So that concludes today's session. Thank you all for joining us.